He and his family, the eight of them, repopulated the entirety of the earth. We're all very familiar with that story. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people in our world who don't believe it. There are many who discount the biblical account of the flood. Some of the arguments that people put forth is that the gathering of the animals would have been impossible. There's no way you could have got two of every kind of animal to come together. Others say the amount of food that's necessary to feed the people and the animals for a year on board the ark, there's no way that's going to fit in there. And some people who try to combine evolutionary teachings with biblical teachings will simply say that it wasn't a global flood, it was just a regional flood, limited to the Mesopotamia region, which is basically where most anything you read in the Bible happens, right? So there are many people who don't believe this. So what I'd like to do this evening is I would like to look at the evidence for the global flood that occurred during the days of Noah. And in the end, we're going to put some very practical application, do all this together. Now, as I do this, I want you to think about this from a skeptic's perspective, right? So a skeptic doesn't want to believe in this. And here is why. Evolutionists teach history based on Darwin's ideas and based upon the geological timetable. If you are a parent, you've got kids, you've made it to fifth or sixth grade, you need to know what that is, because I promise you it is in your children's science book. And by the way, it's also contrary to what's in the Bible. You see, they are against it because if the flood of Noah occurred, as the Bible teaches, then the entire evolutionary timetable is thrown off. And scientists who say, oh, this happened 18 and a half million years ago or 32 billion years ago, whatever number they throw out, right? If the flood of Noah happened, they have no way of dating it and saying, oh, this happened that long ago, because basically what happened with the flood would throw off everything they do with their measurements. In fact, the number one tool scientists use when dating these things, you've probably heard about it, you've heard about carbon dating, right? Or carbon 14 dating more specifically. Listen to what Richard Dawkins, the world's most outspoken atheist, has to say about carbon 14 dating. This is in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. He said, carbon 14 dating is useful for dating organic material on the archaeological historical time scale. We're dealing with hundreds of years or a few thousands of years, but it's no good on the evolutionary time scale where we're dealing with millions of years. Would you like to know why that is? It's because of the flood that occurred during the days of Noah. Because if the flood of Noah, we call it that, right? It's the flood that God brought during the days of Noah. If this flood occurred as the Bible teaches, and I firmly believe that it did, then this would explain the problem that science has dating materials. So again, I'd like for us this evening to begin from a skeptic's point of view. A skeptic would ask, is there any historical evidence outside of the Bible that the flood of Noah occurred? And the answer comes back with a resounding yes. You see, every major culture on every continent across the world has a flood legend associated with it. Now, according to scholars, there are over 200 flood legends in the world. According to evolutionary geologist Robert Schock, I'm going to be reading some quotes here tonight, folks, so y'all please bear with me as I do that. I know how tedious that gets sometimes, but it's important for what we're talking about. He said, narratives of a massive inundation are found all over the world. Stories of a great deluge are found on every inhabited continent among a great many different languages and culture groups. What's that mean? It means flood stories are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Dr. John Morris of the Creation Research Institute wrote, one of the strongest evidences for the global flood, which annihilated all people on earth except for Noah and his family, has been the ubiquitous presence of flood legends, and the stories are all so similar. Now, as I say this, I'm going to put the emphasis on the word similar. They are not identical, but they got a lot of the same characteristics to them. There's a man by the name of James Perloff who wrote Tornado in a Junkyard, The Relentless Myth of Darwinism. And in it, he addressed these similarities. He said, among these 200-plus flood legends, in 95% of them, the flood was worldwide. In 88% of them, a certain family was favored. In 70%, survival was by means of a boat. 67%, animals were also saved. 66%, the flood was due to the wickedness of man. 66%, the survivors had been forewarned. And 57% of these stories, they ended up on a mountain. And 35%, birds were sent out of the boat. And in 9%, exactly 8 people were saved from the flood. Bert Thompson looked at this and he said, basically, well, once you look at all these stories and you put them away and you remove the dressing that people like to add, you know how it is when somebody tells a story, you add something to it. We call those grandma stories sometimes. My grandma used to tell stories, and every time you heard it, that story got longer and longer and longer. And a 2-minute story can wind up being a half hour by the time you're said and done a few years later, right? By the time all the trappings are removed and stripped away down to the kernel of the truth, these 200 flood stories are basically the exact same thing. Why is it? Because they're all based upon the biblical account of Noah's flood. This is the most well-known flood story in the world, by the way, the flood that occurred during the days of Noah. But did you know that the Quran also references this? In the Quran, there is a great flood in which there is a principal character by the name of Noah. That sounds a lot like Noah to me. What about you guys? The principal character of Noah, who was able to survive the flood. Outside of that, perhaps the most well-known, if you're examining history, and like I said, I know this is a little different, but if you're examining history, there's something known as the Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh. And in this story, the gods became angry at man, and so they were going to destroy the world with a flood. But Ea, the God who created man, warned... I'm going to butcher some of these names. I'm just going to tell you now, okay? Utnapishtim, to build a boat and to take all living beings on it. And the boat landed on a mountaintop. And 8 people survived the flood. And when they came off the boat, they made a sacrifice to God. According to Greek mythology, Prometheus warned Deucalion and Pyrrha about an impending worldwide flood. So they didn't build a boat, they built a chest. I guess that's one on one side, one on the other. They then survived the flood, and when the flood ended, they landed on top of a great mountain. What about the Chaldeans? They've got a rich history, right? They've got a legend about someone named Xisthros, who was warned of an impending flood by Cronos, who told him to build a boat in order to save his family and take 2 of every kind of animal. At the end of the flood, the boat landed on a mountaintop and they made a sacrifice to their god. What about China, most heavily populated country in the world, right? According to Chinese records, the family of Fui survived the great flood by building a boat in which Fui, his wife, his 3 sons, and his 3 sons' wives managed to survive the flood while everyone else perished, and they then repopulated the earth. Okay, you said every continent. What about America, right? Okay, there are too many Native American stories about a flood to even recount. I'm just going to tell you one of them, okay? According to the Chippewa Indians, a battle broke out between one of their great warriors and the great serpent which lived at the bottom of Lake Superior. The serpent was wounded in the fight and vowed to destroy them all with a great flood. So the tribe built rafts in which they and the animals escaped, landed on top of the highest mountain, and they alone were the only ones left to go forth and repopulated the earth. There are stories like this on every continent, all over the world, and they all have the same base elements. Now, why do you think these stories are so similar? It's because they're built... They are based upon the truth of what happened that's recorded in the Bible. They're based upon the global flood of Noah that occurred during the days of Noah. Dr. Jonathan Sarfati of the Creation Institute wrote this: "It is common to make legends out of historical events, but not history from legends. For instance, in Genesis' flood, God's judgment is just and he's patient with mankind for 120 years. He shows mercy to Noah and is sovereign. Then you look at something else. You look at the Epic of Gilgamesh, in which case he says the gods are capricious, they're squabbling, they're petty, and without mankind to feed them, they're famished like they're going to die. Basically, he said they took the story of Noah and they made God in their image as to how they would have responded in this situation. You may be saying, okay, I get it. There's evidence. There's multiple stories from history about the flood. They're spread all over. I get that. What about scientific evidence? Let's start this evening by using evolution's poster child, the dinosaur. There are a great many theories as to how dinosaurs became extinct. Here's something interesting about it. The overwhelming majority of dinosaur fossils that have been discovered in clusters, that is, mass graveyards. Like they were all forced together somehow in this one area, and they all rapidly died together. What could cause this to happen? Science offers many explanations, but there are two which are the most popular. The first one is this, that a mile-wide asteroid hit the Earth and caused such cataclysmic damage that the dinosaurs couldn't breathe and ultimately died. What that doesn't explain is how lesser beings, people for one, birds, other types of animals, how they survived. And it also doesn't explain why they're all grouped together in these mass graveyards. The second most popular explanation that science offers, and this is science's explanation, not mine, okay? Mass volcanic activity occurred all at once due to depletions in the ozone layer. This caused infertility in the dinosaurs, and they ultimately died out. So evidently, some evolutionists feel that dinosaurs had a problem with global warming. Even so, that still doesn't explain these mass dinosaur graveyards or how lesser beings, again, could survive. They've got other theories like plague, alien hunters, and dinosaurs eating their own eggs, and some so utterly ludicrous that it's not even worth thinking about and reading. So the question arises, what could happen that would lead to all of these mass dinosaur graveyards where they're all clustered together in one or two or three big piles like this? And the answer is a worldwide flood. When scientists try to explain these graveyards, they all basically say the exact same thing. There had to have been a flood. But they're very careful in how they say that. They don't say it was a global flood. They don't say it was the flood that occurred during the days of Noah. No, they say things like it was a seasonal flood. It was rapidly moving water, a flash flood, or heavy flooding. You find it interesting that scientists would use a flood to explain these things? Because the Bible doesn't spell it out that way, but I think there's an implication when you look at it that this is exactly what happened. Now, maybe you would like some evidence a little bit closer to home than the dinosaurs, right? Consider this. In 1976, scientists discovered fossils of a 75-foot-long baleen whale in Lompoc, California, lying at a 45-degree angle. Now, this angle is very interesting in and of itself, but what's more interesting is the fact that the animal was completely intact. It hadn't been scavenged. Other fish had not come along and nibbled at it and taken bites. And even more so, it was covered in diatomaceous earth. Now, according to evolutionists, the process of something being covered in diatomaceous earth takes millions of years to occur. So do you think that there's going to be a long, tasty 75-foot meal sitting here for millions of years, undisturbed, and ultimately covered in diatomaceous? Or how would something like that happen? The only logical common sense answer would be that something happened where this animal was forced down and suddenly rapidly covered in this and ultimately becomes covered in diatomaceous earth. The only explanation that makes any sense is a massive flood. There are logical problems, too, if you think about this, because if this was just a local flood, if it was something that was limited to the Mesopotamia area, right? Why would Noah then need to build an ark? Wouldn't it have been easier just to, you know, say, hey, let's get up, let's move, let's go over here to this region, we'll avoid the flood altogether. The ark was not just a warning for mankind. It was a means by which God would save Noah. God would save Noah through his obedient faith by getting into the boat and God then bringing the water. Another question skeptics frequently ask about the flood is, well, what happened to all this water? You got enough water to cover the earth? Where did it go? The Bible actually answers this one for us in Psalm 104, beginning in verse 5. Psalm 104, beginning in verse 5. You who laid the foundations of the earth so that it should not be moved forever, you covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the voice of your thunder they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They went down into the valleys, to the place which you founded for them. You have set them as a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. This passage tells us, basically, that the mountains rose and the valleys sank during the flood. And God, who created the waters, who summoned the waters, then sent the waters to the place which He has reserved for it. I'm going to read something to you. It is a quote from creationwiki.org. We all know that everything on the internet is true, right? Bonjour. There is enough water on the earth for a global flood. If the earth were smoothed out, the water in the ocean would cover it to the depths of about 8,800 feet. That does not include the water in the rivers, lakes, and glaciers. That would add another 2,000 to 3,000 feet. In reality, the flood would only need to be a little over 7,000 feet deep. So the real question is whether it is possible for Mount Everest to have risen to its current height fast enough to fit a timescale consistent with the flood. Consider the earthquake that caused the Indonesian tsunami on December 26, 2004. It caused an uplift of at least 20 feet in a matter of minutes, which is a speed of about 240 feet per 5 days. 240 feet per hour. At that rate, Mount Everest could have reached its current height in about 5 days. Forces observed in an earthquake are sufficient, if extended long enough, to quickly raise the highest mountain to its current height in just a few days. Why am I throwing all this stuff out at you? It's weird. It mixes with the Bible, but it's not, you know, what you usually expect to hear in a sermon, right? I do this because our faith is under attack. And if you don't know these things, if our children don't know these things, what's going to happen when they leave home and they go to college? Maybe not even college, maybe even junior high or high school. And they've got a teacher who throws about 10 big words out at them in two paragraphs, and they feel utterly lost because they don't know what they mean. We have to know what we believe. We have to know why we believe it. And for some who argue that this never occurred, we have to be able to say something other than, because the Bible told me so. That's like going and starting an argument with an atheist by saying the fool has said in his heart, there's no God. You know what he's doing when you say that, right? He's laughing at you. The flood is entirely possible. There is mass evidence for it, including a lot we don't have time to get into, but we find the answers to most of our questions about this in the Bible. Knowing we have the evidence of the flood, another concern expressed by doubters is this. How did Noah manage to get two of every kind of animal into the ark? I think the Bible answers this one pretty clearly for us in Genesis 6 and verses 19 and 20. Of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind and animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will what? They will come to you to keep them alive. How did Noah get the animals into the ark? He didn't have to become an animal wrangler and go rope them down and tie them up and go feed them while he's out hunting other animals. The animals all came to him. Why did they do it? They did it because God sent them to him. You don't think God can do that? Go back and read Genesis 2. That's exactly what God did. God caused every kind of animal to come and stand before Adam, and Adam named them. Another concern expressed is whether or not the ark could hold that many animals. The first thing we need to consider with regard to this is that the Bible commanded two of every kind to be taken into the ark. It doesn't say take two of every breed. So we've got two dogs on the ark, not two spaniels, two schnauzers, two labs. Some people may look at that and go, wait a minute, you're telling me that all the, I don't even know how many breeds of dogs there are, but every breed of dog on the earth came from one pair 4,600 years ago, because that's when the Bible tells us the flood occurred? If you think that is ridiculous, let me ask you to consider the only other alternative, evolution, which says not only that all of these dogs came from one thing, but all cats, apes, giraffes, whales, fish, and people all came from the same organism, which originated in the sea, transported itself into land, and ultimately evolved into everything you see before you. When you think about it, what I'm telling you is a lot easier to believe than what evolution teaches. The second thing we need to consider is the size of the ark itself. Verses 15 and 16. This is how you shall make the ark. The length of it shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark. You shall finish it to a cubit from the door and set the door and the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. A cubit, by standard definition, is 18 inches. There are sources which will put it anywhere from 17 to 21 inches, but by standard, that's 18 inches. That's a foot and a half long. So this makes the ark 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Outside of what we see referenced here in Genesis 6, 7, and 8, we don't see mankind able to come anywhere near close to building anything like this until we get to the 20th century. Scholars, boatsmiths have looked at it and said that the size, the shape, the dimensions of the ark are perfect for surviving a storm. Not for steering, because Noah wasn't steering. The whole purpose was just to float and to keep them alive. Using the total area and the most conservative estimates, this would give the ark 95,700 square feet. In his 1973 book, The World That Perished, John Whitcomb said of this, that this boat, would hold the equivalent to 525 modern-day railroad freight cars. How long have you guys stood at a railroad track, stopped as the train goes on and on and on? And you could listen to the long version to Stairway to Heaven, followed by the long version of Freebird. Those boxcars are pretty big, right? This would be more than enough space to hold the animals, to hold the people, to hold the food, to hold everything that is needed according to its own kind. Now, I've been talking about the evidence for it, right? We're building up our faith. We're learning more about why we believe what we believe. We're not just accepting these things on blind faith because mom and dad said so. We're looking at it. We're doing what the Bereans did, searching the scriptures to see whether or not these things are so, and we're comparing it. I have no problem putting true science and the Bible side by side on any day of the week. Notice I said true science, not, oh, I believe this, so I'm going to stick with it, and I'm going to ignore what this says because I don't like it. True science is going to look into it and match it up and see. You see, there are many times science has thought it has been right, only to prove wrong. Science used to think that the world was flat. Science used to think that the galaxy circled around the sun, right? Science once thought that if someone was sick, the answer is to put leeches on them and to drain the blood out of someone. We now know, going back looking at the Bible says what? The blood is necessary for life. The Bible says God holds a circle of the earth on nothing. Okay, we can go on and on with that. What I'm saying is this. In the roughly 1900 plus years since the Bible was finished being written, there has not been an error found in what was written. How many times has science had to go back and change its hypothesis and its theory and its fact? I will put true science side by side with the Bible any day. We've been focusing on that. Now we've been building our faith up. Let's get to the reality of what it means for you and I today. Not only that we need to know what we believe and why we believe it. Why would Almighty, all-loving God send a flood on mankind and destroy all but 8 people from the face of the earth? Let's read what the Bible says in Genesis 6, beginning in verse 1. Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful. And they took wives for themselves among all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth. He was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. The flood occurred when the sons of God, whole lengthy lesson there, short version, the descendants of Seth, looked upon the daughters of men, that's the descendants of Cain, and saw that they were beautiful. And as you look at Genesis in those first few chapters, and you read some of the things about the descendants of Seth, how men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Then you read about the descendants of Cain, Lamech, and some of the others. And everything is evil, self-centered, intent, thought only. These two came together. And ultimately, the evil corrupted the good. So that all mankind thought about was self, self, self. Evil, evil, evil. There wasn't a thought that went through mankind's mind throughout the day that wasn't only evil continually. And God, seeing this, was sorry that he made man. Man not only sinned, but he continued to sin. And God could no longer tolerate it. So he brought a day of judgment on mankind. Only Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, so only he and his family were saved. 2 Peter 3 talks about this flood and also talks about another day of judgment that will come on man, a final day of judgment. He compared this final day, which is yet to come, with the day of judgment from when God closed the door to the ark and brought the flood waters upon the earth. It will be a complete destruction for everyone who is not in Christ, just like it was complete destruction for everyone who was not in the ark. The Lord will return and judge the world in righteousness. So my question to you is this. Are you ready? If the Lord were to return right now, would you be ready to stand before him? Would you be able to look upon his face with joy in your heart and say, this is the day I've been waiting for so long? Or would you, knowing this day had come, have terror in your heart? Would you be on your knees looking for a place to hide? Say, maybe there's somewhere I can hide that he won't see me because I know my heart's not right. Because I know I haven't been doing right. I haven't been living my life for the Lord. My heart drifted long ago, and it's only just now that I see him that I'm actually thinking about the fact that my mind and my heart should have been somewhere else. If we were to sing Blessed Assurance right now, could you truly sing it? Or would you be sitting there singing it with your fingers crossed? I hope, I wish, blessed assurance, Jesus is mine. I hope, I wish for a foretaste of glory divine. If you are not in a right relationship with God, why? What is it that is so important that you're willing to risk your eternal soul? Think upon that if you're not in a, and if for any reason you're not in a right relationship with God this evening, we offer you the invitation. Will you please come as together we stand and sing?